Before we, thank you. This meeting is being recorded. Before we dive right in, we have a couple of logistical Zoom meeting announcements. I'm going to hand it over to our Spanish language translator, Victor, who will just provide some quick instructions for anyone who wishes to have this meeting translated into Spanish. Victor?
Thank you. I'll provide the message both in English and Spanish. I'll start with English first. Welcome, everyone. Today's meeting will be offered in English and Spanish. If you're joining us through a
One moment, my apologies. I think the translation went whoops. One moment here.
Thank you.
Victor?
Yes.
Victor, my apologies. I accidentally started the translation before you had a chance to announce your make your announcement in English and Spanish. So sorry, go ahead.
No
Please start
problem. Thank you.
over.
Welcome, everyone. English and Spanish will be available for this meeting. So if you're joining us through a desktop or laptop computer, please click the globe icon that will be appearing in just a few moments, at the bottom of your screen. Or if you're joining through the Zoom app using a mobile device such as smartphone or a tablet, there will be three dots at the bottom right or upper right-hand side of your screen. And you will be able to select language interpretation from that menu. If you prefer to hear the meeting in English, please select English. Or if you prefer Spanish, select Spanish. You must choose a language in order to not miss any of today's content. If you have any questions, please send us a message in the chat or raise your virtual hand so we can try to help you. Thank you and welcome. Muy bienvenidos a todos. Inglés y español estarían disponibles para esta reunión. Si está usando una computadora de escritorio o portátil, haga clic en el icono de globo que se va a encontrar en la parte inferior derecha de su pantalla de su computadora, que va a aparecer en unos minutos. Y si está usando la aplicación de Zoom a través de un dispositivo móvil como un teléfono inteligente o una tableta, presione los tres puntos con la leyenda más y en la parte derecha o parte superior derecha de la pantalla. De esa manera podrá seleccionar su idioma preferido. Si desea escuchar la reunión en inglés, seleccione inglés o si prefiere español, seleccione español. Si tiene alguna pregunta, por favor envíenos un mensaje en el chat o levante su mano virtual en Zoom para poder ayudarle. Gracias y bienvenidos. Ok, I am ready. And you should be able to see the globe icon appearing very soon.
Thank you, Victor. I will start translation service. And a reminder that everyone must choose a language channel, regardless of whether it is English or Spanish. So everyone must go and click the globe icon when it pops up and choose the English or Spanish language feature. So here we go. Okay, so hopefully everyone has chosen at the very bottom their feature, the globe icon. There's a toolbar at the bottom of the Zoom screen. And I see some heads. There we go. Hopefully everyone has chosen their English channel. I will go ahead and start presentation here. Okay, so thanks again, everyone, for joining. This is the first community meeting for the climate-friendly areas in the Southern Rogue Valley region. Quick logistics, of course. The meeting is going to be recorded. Please do go ahead and mute yourself when not talking. And as I just mentioned, do select the correct interpretation channel. So regardless of whether you want this in English or Spanish, you must choose your language. And when prompted, if you have any questions during the Q&A, please do go ahead and use the raise hand function. Also, feel free to submit questions and comments using the chat feature as well. So quick overview for this evening. We have until about 8 p.m. I'll do a quick little welcome, introductions, and overview. And then we're going to go into a presentation on what climate-friendly areas is all about. That will be given by the Department of Land Conservation and Development staff. And then we'll break out into a 10-minute Q&A session. After that Q&A session, we will host three breakout rooms that will be organized by cities. So the city of Medford, the city of Ashland, and the city of Talent. Those breakout rooms are going to be an opportunity for folks to chat with city staff and ask for some more, if there are any more specific questions that you have regarding each community. And then we will come back in the main room about 15 minutes prior to adjourning the meeting to talk about next steps and what is coming up. There's a number of folks on the line today, and we won't go around and do all introductions, but I did just want to let everyone know that we have a number of city staff on the line. We have city staff from the city of Medford, Ashland, and Talent here to provide local knowledge, expertise, along with many other things as part of this planning process. My name is Anais Mate, and I am a community engagement specialist and land use planner with 3J Consulting, and we are the consulting firm that is here to support the cities as well as the RVCOG in doing this work. The RVCOG, City of Medford, both entities that are developing the maps, doing the technical analysis behind the scenes for the climate-friendly area work, and developing the climate-friendly study report. I will have the RVCOG stands for the Rogue Valley Council of Governments. And then finally, last but not least, we have a number of DLCD staff, so Department of Land Conservation and Development staff, that are here for technical assistance about the rules, and they'll be able to provide us with a more detailed presentation about what this is about, what climate-friendly areas is all about. Quick schedule or overview of the CFA, as we like to abbreviate it. We are currently studying CFA areas across the region. The identification of potential climate-friendly areas essentially kicked off this winter. There are multiple rounds of engagement that are slated over the next 6 months. This is the first of three major rounds of engagement as cities and your COGs are developing the technical analysis and establishing potential CFA areas. The deadline for that work will be June 30th, 2023, and then the cities and the RVCOG will launch into the CFA adoption phase, which should conclude by the end of 2024. And of course, just quickly, how do we engage through this work? Of course, always contact local city staff. They are doing a lot of the work in conjunction with the RVCOG around climate-friendly areas. Please go ahead and sign up for the mailing list. Every city should have information about CFAs on their website. Attend these community meetings like this one this evening. So you've all already done one. And as we have opportunities for online surveys, please be on the lookout for those and take them as they come. And then, of course, if there's any interest, we will be asking volunteers for focus group discussions that will be coming up next in the coming months. So there will be an opportunity to volunteer for those towards the end of this meeting. Okay, so with that, I'm going to go ahead and stop sharing my screen. I'm going to hand it over to Evan Manvel, who is a staff member with DLCD and is going to walk us through a presentation for climate-friendly areas. Evan, tell us what you know.
Thanks so much, Anais, and thank you, everyone, for making some time this evening to join us. My name is Evan Manvel. I'm a climate mitigation planner at the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm joined by my colleagues, Cody Meyer and Josh LeBombard. Unfortunately, the foremost expert on climate-friendly areas wasn't able to attend, but I think Cody and I should be able to answer most questions, and Josh. So Climate Friendly Air and Equitable Communities. It's a program that our department has set up and is working with local governments to implement. What's it about? So our commission realized we had some key problems in the state and launched this program, launched a rulemaking, and we're now in the implementation part of this program for several reasons. One is we're really missing Oregon's pollution reduction goals, particularly in the transportation sector. And that has real world costs, as you all and people around Oregon really know, more devastating wildfires more often, heat waves, people losing their homes, people losing their lives. So getting back on track to the legislative policy and goal of reducing climate pollution significantly by 2050 will take some real work. We got to course correct. We're currently significantly off course, and that has real impacts for Oregonians. The second main thrust of the rulemaking is equity. And our land use and transportation systems in the past, over the past many decades, have really been used in a way that has harmed certain populations, the people not in power, people of color, poorer people, people with disabilities, et cetera. Both are redlining that it then became illegal, and then exclusionary zoning that took its place. It's concentrated wealth for some people at the expense of others. And that has intergenerational effects because most generational wealth goes through property and homes. It means that people generations ago who got shut out of wealth creation from homes, their descendants now have a lot fewer homes. And the average Black household has about one-tenth the wealth as the average white household. So land use has played a big role in that. Transportation, where we've located our highways and things, has also played a big role in that. So we have some real equity issues. And all of those, both climate and equity, are very very tied to the housing crisis and the housing challenges. So lots of different reasons to take on this program. And that's what our commission directed us to do, and create a program, create some rules, and create a program. It applies in about two-thirds of Oregon, or rather where two-thirds of Oregonians live, roughly, in the metro areas, those places where there are more than 50,000 people in a concentrated area, these eight areas in the state. You can see them. There's the Rogue Valley. Go Rogue Valley. It doesn't apply on the coast or in eastern Oregon or up to Gorge or various other places that are more dispersed, but that those are the places that this program is working. Now, the program updated Oregon's land use and transportation rules. These are rules that the state has on how local plans, what local plans can do in their zoning and transportation plans. And they updated them in six main areas. The first is the main thrust of tonight, which is designating climate-friendly areas, walkable places that you can get around without having to drive everywhere. They reform parking management. They support electric vehicle charging. And on the transportation side, they turn up the volume on planning for higher quality pedestrian, bicycle, transit infrastructure. Thinking about measuring success in transportation beyond just saying how congested or is it for people driving. And thinking about how to build a project list for what we invest in to collectively meet our climate and equity outcomes, as well as locally identified performance measures. So that's the thrust of what we did. The rules changing all that were adopted by the commission in July. And now we're working with local governments to implement those rules. So the Climate Friendly Areas Program, 15 communities under the rules are asked to identify climate-friendly areas. And what does that mean? I think the easiest way to think about a climate-friendly area is to think of a downtown or to think of a neighborhood center. Think of a place where you can go and do more than one thing. You go and you have lunch, and then you go have a meeting, or you go you drop off your dry cleaning and you walk over to have coffee or meet somebody, or you go to work and you can go out to lunch without having to get in your car. So they're walkable areas where you can meet more than one of your needs at a time. A mix of, and what's key in climate-friendly areas, it's that mix. It's that mix of residential and office and retail and services. So we have a lot of these climate-friendly areas in Oregon, or things that are on their way to meeting the requirements. And that's really what we want you to picture. They tend to have high quality pedestrian, bicycle, and transit services, and they're required to under these rules. And parking is well managed. That it's not a lot of parking everywhere, pushing uses apart and making it harder to get around. So our rules require certain things for climate-friendly areas. Where can they be located? And generally, we're imagining communities are going to choose where they've already got a good start on it and just, again, turning up the volume a little bit. So looking at existing and planned urban centers like downtowns, transit corridors, neighborhood centers, having the characteristics I mentioned a little bit about transportation choices, that the infrastructure there is able to support if we have more housing and more people living there, as well as more mixed use development. They can't be in hazardous areas for obvious reasons, and they can't be really narrow. They can be pretty narrow, but they have to have some dimensions where you can have a critical mass of people walking around. So land use requirements on the zoning side, it can't just be a single use. It has to have a broad variety of housing types and other use types like offices, services, commercial. And it's possible that some things right next to it can add into the overall size of the climate-friendly area. As we're developing these climate-friendly areas, we want to make sure that the other things that make it a great place to be and get around are there. Public facilities, open space, parks. It's not saying that's the only place cities can put those things, but it's asking, hey, let's think about that and prioritize making sure those areas are vibrant. There are some minimum block length standards, and there can't be limitations to maximum density. One of the things that's caused these not to happen as often is we put in a lot of red tape, and we're trying to, a lot of the thrust of the rule and the program is to legalize developing this where the market supports it. So you're looking at the climate-friendly area requirements and the rules are sized based on population, you can kind of see what they are. Talent needs to identify at least 25 acres to for climate-friendly area zoning and development. Ashland and Medford have to do something that could theoretically meet 30% of your housing need in the future. So is there enough that if it was developed, that 30% of the population could live there at least? Beyond that, there are two options for communities. We heard during the rulemaking that people wanted to come up with, have the ability to create something that was more creative instead of a clear cut, here are some numbers and lines and prescriptions. And so we have an outcomes option that says, hey, bring us a plan that will result in 20 homes and jobs per net acre or 40 homes and jobs per net acre for Medford. Or if that's not something you want to do, change your zoning so it has certain minimum density requirements and has a building height no less than 50 feet or 85 feet in Medford. So, and the last nuance to this, not to get too wonky, is that only one of the, you can have multiple CFA climate-friendly areas in a community. So you can designate some, and only one has to, the primary climate-friendly area has to meet the 85-foot standard. So again, just to be clear, these aren't saying every building needs to be built up to 50 feet or 85 feet, just the communities have to allow it if that's what the local builders want and there's a market for. So, that's the basic dimensions of a climate-friendly area. Today, I've got another slide. Feel free to jump in, Cody, if I'm going over something too fast or, okay, thank you. And the last thing about this slide, the minimum density, if it's a mixed-use development, that doesn't apply. So that's that little fine thing. Okay. As Anais mentioned, the process and the calendar is we have funded some assistance, both in engagement and in technical analysis, to help with the study of them, where these might go in your communities. And that's going to be done at the end of this year. And you're going to have a sense of where they might go, how close your current codes are to what's required by the rules, thinking about how the community should be engaged between now and when the final decision to zone and adopt the areas is done. And then thinking about it as these climate-friendly areas happen, what's the potential for displacement, particularly of underserved populations and traditionally marginalized folks, and how can we mitigate that? So think about that before you take the actions to actually adopt the zoning. So that's the process. And then next year, probably, although you can move faster if you wanted to, but is by the end of next year, you've actually taken the land use actions. You've adopted and zoned one or more climate-friendly areas in your community, and you've done some more documentation, and it's comes into your zoning plan or your comprehensive plan and thinking about displacement and those sorts of things. We heard during the rulemaking from our advisory committee and others that both the benefits and drawbacks of having a climate-friendly area in a place with a high concentration of underserved populations, that there's some clear benefits to these areas, but they're concerned about displacement. So, I think this is our last slide. There are a lot of benefits to these climate-friendly areas. Not everyone's going to want to live in them, and not everyone has to, or not even a majority of a community has to. There are some benefits, though. Hopefully, this has some more local opportunities for jobs and housing for those who want to work and live in these areas. The process itself is meant to provide some local options in zoning and how you meet the requirements. We've heard some concerns that, hey, this means other stuff won't be built. And that doesn't really play out in terms of state law, the state statute, and our rules very much say, hey, other types of development can happen elsewhere. And that's neither here nor there. This doesn't impact this. The climate-friendly areas overall, the ability for housing stock expands under this program, I guess I should say. The climate-friendly areas also have what we think is a less burdensome review process for big projects that might have some impact on the transportation system. So lots of benefits. As I mentioned, some concern about gentrification caused displacement and trying to make sure that as we think through strategies to address that displacement, that there are some resources available for that. Because a lot of the anti-displacement strategies need some resources. So some challenges. Yeah, so that's a high-level overview of this. We do have a mailing list that we provide ongoing materials to the community about what's happening across the state with these efforts. And we have a website with a bunch of handouts and way too much material. So dig in as you like. Anything to add before we open it up to questions, Cody or Josh or any of our local government partners, critical things that weren't in that overview?
Thanks, Evan. Appreciate the presentation. So we're going to open it up at 7 o'clock We're going to open it up to about 10 minutes or so of broad Q&A. Do note that it won't be the end of the Q&A session. So if there is more, there are more things you'd like to discuss, we will start breakout rooms in about 15 minutes. And each breakout room will be organized by city. So there will be an opportunity to continue discussion or ask more specific questions regarding Ashland or Medford or talent in those breakout rooms. But for now, let's see if there's any questions. Feel free to either use the chat function or go ahead and raise your hand and we'll call on you and you can unmute yourself. There are lots of folks in this room, so I will do my best to keep an eye on both the chat and the raised hand function. Lynn, go ahead.
My question has to do with historic districts and the standards that cities have developed regulating development in them. And I'm wondering if there's any accommodation for that in these regulations or whether the notion maybe is that you draw your climate friendly area outside of your historic areas if you don't want to, increase heights and densities and affect the texture of your historic area. Did you hear me?
I did hear that question.
Yeah. Okay.
And this is where I want to phone a friend and follow up, Kevin. It's not a question we've heard a lot. I don't have. Do you have a quick answer on that, Cody? Or thoughts?
I don't. I think it's just really going to come down to how this plays out in each city, and if that's a candidate area, that would be definitely a consideration to look at. So. Just something to keep an eye on. And I don't know, James, do you want to chime in if you're looking at some candidates? So,
for sure. I think there's a great contextual example in what the city of Ashland is hoping to do with their downtown district. Evan mentioned that there are those prescriptive and outcome-oriented standards where you can either reform the zoning code to allow for greater minimum density or increased building heights. But that prescriptive, that outcome-oriented option allows you to identify your CFA based on how many units and jobs it produces. And so that allows the city of Ashland to potentially designate their CFA in a more historic area and essentially cite the fact that because the area produces so many jobs and it's not required to adhere to those very stringent height-based standards or unit densities that's associated with the prescriptive path.
Thanks, James.
Thank you. Matt from City of Medford, did you have a question or should I run over to the chat? Because I think we have a couple questions there.
No, I was just going to provide a little bit of a response to Lynn.
Great.
If a climate-friendly area were designated in an area where there is a lot of historic development, for example, downtown Medford, any future development would still have to go through historic review. So just because something is in a CFA doesn't mean that it is exempt from that kind of review. And so hopefully, historic preservation goals are able to be met at the same time we're implementing the CFAs.
Thanks, Matt, for that clarification. I'm going to turn to the chat. There's a couple of questions that came up. The first from Steve, most planning jurisdictions have been maximizing the efficiency of land use and following design principles for highly livable communities for most of the 21st century. What's to keep a city from simply designating their most recently developed subdivision as their token CFA and calling it good?
So I can take a stab at this. As Evan described, their rules have some locational criteria, and we know that this isn't new, that all the cities here today are already planning for very similar areas in their existing zoning codes. So the rules really say to go to those existing planned mixed-use areas, downtowns, transit corridors, and kind of start there. So build on your strengths that you're already working on. And this work is already happening, and it really sets a kind of like a minimum standard for how much and where, or not where, but how much. So we don't expect to see it in Greek or some subdivision or somewhere where it doesn't make sense.
Thanks, Cody. Next, is there a lawsuit challenging this program?
Sure. There are two legal challenges to this program. Challenging basically on our overall authority and the process by adoption. We believe we had the authority and we followed the correct process. The rules are currently in effect. Those challenges are being considered by the Court of Appeals. But until a court says that the rules are not valid, they are valid.
Thanks, Evan. What kind of financial support is available from the state beyond the planning stage, like new bills in the legislature?
So there's a lot of new money coming out of Washington, D.C. From the IIJA and the IRA, and DLCD has been partnering with other state agencies on the support that cities will need to see the outcomes of the program. So we currently have a whole raft of funding that's flowing through ODOT and DEQ and Department of Housing and Community Services. So we're actually putting together some guidance and work to help provide a kind of better sense for cities on getting some of that funding in the future.
All right. Another question. So we live near a possible CFA. It has mass transit going in both directions, has commercial and residential already. How wide is the circumference around the central area? Will it be that you can designate that what you are proposing to do should be included as part of the CFA?
Without the specifics, and James might be better equipped if we knew the city we're talking about here, but the minimum size requirement for the main CFA would be 25 acres. And then there's some different dimensional sizes, but I think it's really context specific.
Great, thank you. Going through the questions here. How does this process dovetail with expansion of public transit, and is there funding for this?
So, Cody, I can respond to the transit question, the funding you might want to take on. So, Paige West, Rogue Valley Transportation District Senior Planner, and I was actually on the Rulemaking Advisory Committee as part of this process over the last year and a half or so. So we serve 8 communities in the Rogue Valley area, the MPO area that this rulemaking does affect. Luckily, we have a long-range plan. It's called our 2040 Transit Master Plan that we developed in 2019. And it includes a short-range, mid-range, and long-range transit expansion, contingent on funding, of course. But we did a very robust planning process that is analyzing demographics within each community. Even prior to this rulemaking process, this plan was already underway and adopted. So the demographic process includes low-income households, households with zero or one car, households that are employed and also have zero cars, older adults, people with disabilities. And then also we use the regional problem solving process, which is called the Bear Creek Master Plan that the RVCOG adopted about a decade ago. And that actually charts out future development in many of our communities. And so in some ways, the Rogue Valley is actually set up to have that projected growth known for services in the future. So it was really beneficial for RVTD to be able to understand where those density patterns are going to happen. So we have a plan that goes out to 2040. And we are coordinating with all of the cities. And we, of course, strongly encourage that any of these CFA areas will be in locations where our transit system has already been projected to be. And you can imagine our buses are big. There's only so many roads that our buses can be on. Think a garbage truck or, you know, fire truck. And so we are limited in the areas that we can go and have turnaround points and be efficient. And so we do strongly encourage and hope to coordinate with any of the cities so that we can make sure that the services that we've already identified to be in the future system will be serving the climate-friendly areas. So I feel like we're in a very good position for being able to have that planning process pretty much complete. And we'll just be working with the cities to make sure that we can, you know, coordinate together on the locations of the CFAs.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Paige. Appreciate that. Next question is about legislative oversight and its application in the rulemaking. DLCD or anyone, does anyone want to speak to that?
I'll say a few things on that. Thanks for the question, Bob. Sorry, Brad. So the legislature created DLCD and the Land Conservation Development Commission and gave us certain authorities. The legislature also said it was the policy of the state to reduce climate pollution by 75%. So they've provided some direction. This biennium, they funded this program. They gave us about $1 million to fund this program. And so they've done a variety of things that we think we're in line with. During the rulemaking process, we also did the required legislative notices so they were aware that the rulemaking was being considered and adopted. So that's what happened. Certainly, there are some legislators who are engaged and asking some questions, and we're working with them and trying to make sure everyone understands it. But there's pretty long history of having some authority there. In my opinion. So.
Thanks, Evan. Next question from Bill regarding equity. I hear a lot of discussion about equity to serve or to in order to serve underserved populations. How does CFAs or housing in CFAs help underserved populations gain generational wealth? Which most effectively was gained by purchasing conventional housing. Where is the political democratic political process here? And where does the local population or equity come in submitting to top-down CFA mandates? So a lot of questions here. Additionally, is there legislation enforcing these rules, which Evan just spoke to? So who wants to talk a little bit about how this process is set up to for anti-displacement strategies?
There's a lot here, yeah. So a few things. This rulemaking was guided from the start by equity. We built the most diverse and representative rulemaking advisory committee and the largest in DLCD's history. We funded equity participation in the process and consultants to review it. And we started the rulemaking process by thinking about the equity outcomes we wanted. And so we built an equitable outcome statement, and then we held the rules up to a mirror up to that on how we thought it was going to achieve those outcomes. So it was a really strong connection throughout the rulemaking process. And the equity groups involved and tenant organizations and others voiced their support of the rules and encouraged their adoption. So I come from privilege, so I have to rely on those people to advise what's most likely to help them. My hope, at least, is that it will reduce the transportation cost burden, which is about 20-25% of some households, particularly poorer poorer households by providing more affordable transportation choices. It will hopefully reduce the housing cost burden by having more abundant housing. It's not going to solve the problem of intergenerational wealth. Obviously, home ownership and those things, it's a big challenge. And I don't want to overstate the ability of this rule to solve that. It's not a silver bullet. But those are some hopes as far as equity goes. And we had over 200 meetings. It was a two-year process. It's a different sort of democratic process than voting or some other process rulemaking, but it was very open. There were a lot of meetings around the state virtually because of COVID. But it's not the end of the democratic process. Local governments are engaging in it now, and you're making some local decisions, and we encourage people to be involved. And obviously the legislature and others can make changes going forward. So it's not the end. The program is not set in stone. It's a living program. So I hope I got to most of your, some of most. So.
Thanks, Evan. It's almost 7:15. I'll take these last two questions in the chat, and then we'll set ourselves up for breakout rooms where we can continue this conversation with city staff. So what are the benefits and what are the downsides of being designated as CFA besides height constraints? Is there more government funding assistance? Are there more criteria that must be met in order to exist or create inside that boundary?
I've talked a lot. Do you want to go, Cody?
Sure. Well, I think for property owners inside the CFA boundaries, as Evan spoke to, it reduces a lot of red tape and green lights a lot of development. And we know and we've heard and see that we're in a housing crisis as well. So we really want to make sure that we're allowing housing to be built, especially in places that are good inside centrally located, locational efficient areas. The outcome that we're looking for here and what the rules prescribe is that once the zoning boundaries have been determined, that then projects such as bike ped, transit, in kind of active transportation stuff would be prioritized in these areas. So we really see to get a reduced amount of driving, you not only have to get the land use right, but you need to get the transportation right. So cities will be updating their transportation system plans, putting an emphasis on multimodal projects in these areas. And as I stated earlier, we're working with other state agencies really closely with ODOT to make sure that we can also get funding from state and federal sources prioritized in these areas. So we've got some early indications that there's some interest in some different funding sources that we could kind of prioritize to get those transportation projects built.
Thanks, Cody. Last but not least, a question from Aaron. Curious if approved CFA projects, which are study areas, will need to include other climate-friendly elements such as LED streetlights, passive building design, solar build, native plants and trees, community composting, etc. What are some of the climate or green elements as part of these CFA areas?
Generally, our rules don't speak to that. Some of that's outside of our rulemaking authority, and some of it's just not things that we've built in. There are a few requirements for large parking lots, which is not CFA area specific, but in the rules and other things. But I don't see anything else on this list. Those are often public works decisions and not really our building codes decisions, and it's not our authority or our wheelhouse. Anything I'm missing on that, Cody?
I think, yeah, you're exactly right. It's one of those things that's not my department answer, but there is a general nod and push to green infrastructure, and we are working with Department of Forestry on some green infrastructure guidance and money as well, that we are really hoping that we could steer towards these areas.
Cody or Evan, you might want to also speak to the deployment of EV charging stations as requirement for some types of development. That would be beyond what this, what, you know, what cities necessarily are implementing through their own development codes.
Yeah, thank you. There is a heightened requirement for EV conduit. So just with as new residential development comes in, more of those parking spaces need to be ready for wiring and stations if the market's there. So that's the cheapest time to put it in while you're building, as the state well knows, as we're tearing up our parking lots to put in conduit. It's usually anyway, it's good to do it as you build. So there should be more EV ready spaces for the hopefully coming EV revolution.
Thanks, Evan. And for folks that don't know, EV stands for electric vehicle. So electric vehicles charging. Okay. Thanks all for the questions through the chat and for raising your hand. So as I mentioned, we are going to break out into breakout rooms. There will be three breakout rooms, one for each city. So one for the city of Ashland, the city of Medford, and the city of Talent. There will be a number of city staff from each of those jurisdictions in those breakout rooms. They will be there to answer more questions. We also have some breakout room discussion questions. So let me just go ahead and quickly share my screen. One moment. So the breakout room will be about 30 minutes. We'll come back and break at about 7:45. Here we are. Here are breakout sessions. So you will have the option to choose your room. There will be a little dialogue box that will pop up in a moment here, and you can choose what room you would like to go in. You'll do a little meet and greet with city staff. You'll have an opportunity to discuss what CFA implementation would actually look like on the ground in each of these communities. And please, of course, use the time to chat about what you feel like your ideal outcome of the process should be. What are some opportunities that you see, concerns, constraints? So please feel free to use this time to connect with your city staff and meet some neighbors. And then we will come back together as one in about 27 minutes or so. So I'm going to have Natalie, go ahead. Oh, one more thing. For any Spanish speakers on the line, we will keep all of our Spanish speakers in the main room for the breakout session. We have James from the RVCOG who will be there to help field any questions that will be translated from English to Spanish and then back from Spanish to English. So all Spanish speakers will stay in the main room, and everyone else can go ahead and choose the other, your own breakout room. So Natalie, if you can go ahead and choose your room. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. My apologies if the breakout room ended rather abruptly for some, if you were in the middle of conversations. Hopefully folks saw the broadcasting message and it wasn't too clunky. Thank you, everyone, for bearing with us as we kind of navigated the technical glitches of getting folks in different breakout rooms. I hope that it was informative and was an opportunity to dive a little bit deeper, get clarity on some questions, et cetera. I see that staff from the City of Ashland just dropped in a link to the City of Ashland's web page information about CFAs. If city staff from Medford or Talent want to share any links to their city's websites where there's some more additional information on CFAs, please go ahead and do so. So quick round of next steps. Let's see if I can share my screen again. So next steps here, the cities along with the RVCOG will be working on some technical analysis over the coming months and studying potential areas for CFAs. This next round of outreach, so after this meeting, the next time we will have a community meeting will be around draft maps, essentially, so studying potential areas where these CFA rules may apply. That round of outreach will be in the spring. We'll have a similar meeting to tonight. It will probably or most likely be in person. There will also be an online survey, and we will also be having focus groups as these draft maps become available for each of the jurisdictions. So that's what's coming down the pipeline. I do suggest everyone go ahead and visit the websites of your respective cities, sign up for the mailing list. Information about all of these events, the dates, the times, the places will all be shared via newsletters and e-blasts that will go out well in advance of any of these meeting times. So yeah, with that, I do want to say thank you again to our presenters who walked us through what was probably a lot of technical information, a lot of policy information. So hopefully everyone learned something tonight and came away with a piece of nugget. And we do look forward to continuing this discussion at the next community meeting. And also there, as I mentioned, there are many other opportunities to get involved. Please feel free to reach out to me or your city staff if there are any additional questions or just logistical questions. I'm going to go ahead and dump my email address in the chat. But with that, is there anything else that DLC staff would like to say or city staff would like to say before we close out the meeting?
Well, I would like to acknowledge Commissioner Warren, who's on the line, and one of our LCDC commissioners who helped guide this program. But this program is really going to be successful because you are all engaged now. So really thrilled to have 60 people here tonight learning about this, engaging it, making it work for your community. We really are appreciative that you're here and hope you continue to be engaged and ask questions and reach out if you need help. Thank you.
Thanks, Evan. I just submitted my email address in the chat if there are any follow-up questions. But with that, I hope everyone has a great evening. This meeting was recorded, so we will have the recording available for city staff to post on their websites. So thank you again so much. Have a great evening, and hopefully see you again soon.